Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Hi, it's Martin here, Electronically Yours as always. Well, this is a very special day. We have such a treat for you today. My favourite comic actor, probably of all time, I should imagine. And somebody who I feel a great deal of empathy with on many levels, from creativity to our northern background to art to politics, etc. And he is literally a national treasure, international treasure, Steve Coogan. Little bit starstruck, to be honest, but he's incredibly gracious and self-effacing. And I do genuinely believe he just wants to do the best art he possibly can with his time on Earth. And for that, I have an incredible amount of respect. This is a very in-depth conversation. Some of it touches on some quite profound things. It's not generally hilarious, but it is fascinating. And it's very rare that Steve does any social media or long form interviews like this. So I'm incredibly honoured that he's agreed to do it with me. Thanks, Steve. I really appreciate it. So here he is. No more delays. Here he is, the amazing Steve Coogan. Growing up in Middleton, how exciting was that?
Middleton is what they would call a dormer suburb. It was sort of like a post-industrial sort of a town. Middleton, because it's middleway between Rochdale and Manchester, is why it's called Middleton.
Oh, and, I see.
And so it was. It was very idyllic, actually, because you know my mother. My grandmother and grandfather, who were very working-class Irish immigrants, lived on the council estate, which is called Langley Estate, part of Middleton. And me and my family, my mother still lives actually, grew up in Orquinton, which is the very nice sort of part of Middleton, if you like, or the more sedate part of Middleton. With lawns and cars on the drive and people who wash the cars on Sundays, you know, that sort of place to ride around on your bike, and everything was nice and sort of clean-ish, if you like. But it was, we had a park across the road, and my childhood was going around to see mates, listening to records, riding my bike around, had a paper around. It was all very, you know, sort of enjoyably unremarkable in that respect. You know, it was sort of, I would describe it as lower middle class in terms of my parents. My father certainly was, I would say, had done well for himself. I'm sort of aspirational working class. When I say aspirational, I don't mean materially aspirational, but aspirational in terms of, you know, bettering yourself to be a responsible member of society, contributes to the community. I mean, I always use as a measure that my father in 1977 bought Encyclopedia Britannica rather than a colour television because he thought that was a much better investment than wasting money, as he got on a colour TV. So it was sort of, you know, it was, you know, knowledge was something to be appreciated and learn and all that stuff. And not following the crowd, you know, following the crowd, very important, not doing... And in some ways, since then, I've had an antipathy towards what the majority of people think. Even if it might be right, I just feel uncomfortable being part of the majority view. I think it's unhealthy to just sit comfortably with the majority view without questioning it, without challenging it.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, I've read Easily Distracted, so I, you know,
I feel like I know a lot of detail about your background. But for anybody who's not read it, you should go and buy it or listen to it on Audible or whatever.
It's probably about a pound now in the so it should be quite easy to go.
Is it going to be pulped? Like
partridges.
I'm bouncing back. Yeah. But it's really good. And I particularly like, I mean, I'm obsessed with audiobooks. So I think your, kind of Alan Partridge faux autobiographies are.
Oh, yeah.
Are works of genius, frankly. And I don't use that lightly. I've listened to them more than once. I just think you creating this kind of Partridge cinematic universe is something that I treasure, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people do.
Yeah, that sort of grew accidentally through. It's funny now working with. It started 30 years ago, and I've sort of, you know, and I worked with some great people, and people have come and gone, but now the last 10 years plus, I've been settled with these two fantastic guys called Rob and Neil Gibbons from Sandbach, who are the three of us really, sort of a little magic triangle. The three of us generate stuff, and it's very cozy and comfortable and enjoyable. I was writing with them yesterday. I'll be writing with them today on a live tour. And we come together and work on stuff, and they've started to do other stuff. I go away and do different projects, and I come back to Partridge. It's become a sort of the most comfortable conduit for funny ideas, I suppose. Because, you know, I could have done different. I'm not like obsessed with comedy particularly. I don't really watch that much comedy. I know that Partridge works. I like the fact that he's now a vessel for, you know, funny ideas. And that's why I sort of put the other comedy characters away years ago. And because I was sort of more interested in drama and narrative and telling stories.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything, I don't mind anything, as long as it's got some substance behind it, some it's about something. I just don't like art that has no point of view. I just find it vacuous, it's boring, I'm not interested in it. I like anything that has the point of view or the courage of its convictions, I suppose. So Partridge is any ideas I have, and also dysfunctions or We all have view. Sometimes, I mean, if you're conscious enough, you know, I think we all become aware that we sometimes think things we shouldn't, and you sometimes try and police yourself or question your views. It's always good to. I mean, I think self-doubt is a very important component of growing up.
It can be a pain in the arse, though, can't it?
Yeah, it can. It's a luxury for someone. I said that, you know, nuance, self-doubt, questioning your own point of view, that you might be, you know, you might be wrong about something, you know, that's important.
But, so can I just I want to talk to you about the latest series on the telly, you know, this time.
Oh yeah.
Which, you know, I'm literally like your biggest fan, not just Alan Partridge but the whole shtick. But when I first started watching this time, I thought, you know, it's great that Alan has become this really successful thing, and all of a sudden he has literally made it on his own show and da 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 da. But I kind of, for the first few episodes, it took me a while to get into it because I felt like I wanted him to be, I don't know, I wanted him to be losing, yeah, and he wasn't losing; he was winning. But then, as the series progressed, I understood it more. It was quite an interesting change of tack, I thought.
You sort of have to, unfortunately, you have to spin the character because obviously, you're a character for such a long time, you start to repeat yourself. There's only so many things you can say. And so if you try and spin something, you think, okay, how would he deal with a modicum of success? That then puts a different spin on it. And you think, well, he'd try and settle old scores, he'd try and do this. Or it has to be. There's two things you have to do: see where he is in his life, and also see him reflect the world around him. And that's why it can always be relevant in a way, because you just have him reflect what's going on. You know, the tour, we're writing the tour now, Alan will embrace and talk about, you know, woke values and although he's smart enough to try and embrace things that he thinks will keep him relevant, he really hasn't changed beneath it. He might claim to have had these epiphanies, but he hasn't really. The characters, it's just something that you have to develop. So for example, you're right. When it's comically the well-worn trope, and very very fruitful trope, is that people who are down on their luck, you know, people who are unhappy are often the funniest, you know, and pain is produces a lot of comedy, and so making him successful is risky. But then of course he's always the architect of his own downfall, and you can just chart that again, you know. And then in the live show we're starting from the point of view that he has all his material things, but he has a spiritual hole in his life, this gaping hole that can't be that many people have, and he addresses that and talks about how he's had an epiphany and helps the audience in his view, you know, he's the unreliable narrator, thinks he's presenting a show that will help the audience turn their lives around.
Oh, right. So he's like a kind of life coach.
Yeah, a life coach. He's going to help people fill the spiritual void in their lives because of the things he's been through. But, you're sort of reinventing the wheel because you're trying to do the same thing but do it different. You've got to do the same but do it different. You know, but try not to repeat yourself too much.
My favourite part of the series was when it's Princess Anne, wasn't it, who came in?
Oh yeah.
And the absolute oleaginous—that's the word I'd use—the oleaginous way he tried to address the whole thing, and he fucked it up. It's just so brilliant.
Well, I can't bear. I mean, the thing is, what's great about Partridge is the opportunity to get stuff off your chest, and I cannot bear the royalist sycophancy. I heard Ross Kemp on the radio the other day. He was just cloyingly unbearable. this unmitigated sort of brainless deference to royalty. It drives me nuts.
Absolutely.
I can't bear it. I can't bear flag waving. I think it's just atrocious, the Daily Mail, all that kind of garbage. Having said that, I feel fortunate and proud to be from a country who at its best is tolerant and has a sense of fair play. Remember the opening ceremony at the Olympics? Remember the opening ceremony of the Olympics?
Danny Boyle.
Danny Boyle did this thing. And I looked at it and I thought, do you know what? All those things that he's displaying are things that make me proud to be British. And they're none of the things the Daily Mail would have on their list. And I'm pleased about that. So I think it's, I like the fact he reclaimed the idea of national pride in a way that I thought was really compelling.
Absolutely.
Still is.
Agree more. Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, so going off on a tangent there, instead of gassing on something like this, generally, I don't do social media because I know I'll probably get into trouble for slagging someone up. apart from your podcast, so you're quite privileged.
Oh, thank you.
But normally I sort of slag things off in the privacy of my own home. And if I've got anything I want to get off my chest, I channel it into my work. It's the best way. Secrete things in your work, put it in your work. Then you're kind of fairly immune to things. And
Okay, well, I'll take the flak then because I was a big Corbyn supporter. I am a big Corbyn supporter. I know you were. Several of my friends were. And I can only genuinely believe that had he not been undermined by the powers that be within the Labour Party, which has been subverted as far as I'm concerned, then we would have been, as somebody posted this morning on Twitter, we would have been 4 years into a gentle revolution in this country back towards back towards more socialist policies. And I mean, I'm going to get off this subject because I know we don't want to keep this as light as possible, but it's something I strongly believe in. Every day I try to undermine those fuckers as much as possible. So
I think good art comes from being anti-establishment, and people who coalesce with the establishment and become part of it make bad art.
Yes.
It's that simple. I am, ostensibly a socialist. I don't think, but I think there needs to be within dogma. You need to have the flexibility to if something works and it isn't entirely consistent with your ideology, you need to be able to embrace it and not reject it because it doesn't seem to obey the entire checklist.
Right.
So you need flexibility to say that if that works. And for example, I'm involved in a charity which is started in the community by the people. It's ground up. I like the fact it's ground up. It's them seizing the initiative to try and better themselves in a rundown economic area. The really important charity that's a grassroots movement. It's not a top-down.
Yes.
It's not a top-down imposition. And sometimes that can be at odds with very, very left-wing, like Socialist Workers' Party, people like that, who think the government should provide should impose solutions to working-class people. Because a lot of working-class people don't actually, in fact, the term working class is only used by middle class people talking about the working class. The working class don't describe themselves as working class. They don't want to be working class, most of them. They don't, they have these and the problem is to understand aspirational working class people and not try and group them all together and go, we're going to liberate you all. Having said that, it's a struggle because there are so many vested interests. They don't believe in conspiracies. They're just a collusion of vested interests that keep things the way they are and maintain the status quo and keep the people under that thumb, and including how the message is controlled and all the rest of it. So, you have to... So
not blue.
To me, it's a perennial, perpetual struggle, and you need to be on the side of the angels.
Yeah, I'm with you, mate, and I'm very proud to be part of your gang.
The trouble with Starmer, I think, is that there was that bump that Corbyn got when he galvanised a lot of young people in the election before last. And the trouble with the beer and flags Starmer is that it was the North East campaign, of course, is that it's appealing to a lot of working class Brexiteers who frankly are older and are a dying electorate. They're dying off.
Yeah.
And younger people aren't, have different priorities. And in just appealing to that old fashioned conservative working class Labour vote that gave its vote to Boris Johnson to try and court them, you're risk of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, which is millennials who have different priorities and aren't into beer and flags. You've got to court court the young vote and court the vote of tomorrow. Cultivate them, not go chasing after these people who, deserted you.
Precisely, precisely. Well put. If you were offered a position as an advisor or to the government, there was Labour government, would you be interested in that?
No, I wouldn't. I think because there's also the idea. I mean, the last Labour government was there's sort of an arrogance in feeling that because you're in government that you are on the right side. And, all those human rights abuses that happened with Extraordinary Rendition all happened under the watch of the Labour Party.
That's right.
And the War on Terror, and as it was called. Because I think they thought, well, if we violate human rights, that's all right, because we're the good guys. So, had the Conservative Party been involved in, by proxy, torture at that time, Labour, correctly, would have given them hell for the betrayal of what we call sort of those British principles and the...
Yeah, that's right.
But in actual fact, it wasn't the Conservatives did that. It was a Labour government that oversaw that.
That's right.
And of course, the Tories didn't complain. They're not bothered about torture. It doesn't bother them that much. As long as you do it, as long as you're torturing the right people, then it's fine, basically.
Into Alan Partridge a little bit there. That was
there is a Venn diagram, Martin, where myself
and Alan torture thought. The right people. I just thought it's good.
You should use that. Yeah.
So Paul and Pauline Calf. I mean, I'm very fond of them. I mean, before obviously the day to day and all the Alan Partridge stuff came along, but they were genius because I mean, obviously I'm from the north and. Yeah. There's a lot of commonality between your real life, your characters' lives, and my life, except Manchester's a bit more kind of, you know, a little bit more confident than Sheffield, shall we say. Tell us about Paul and Pauline Calf then.
They just grew out. I mean, Pauline Calf grew out of just the idea of, well, I look like, if he had a sister, she'd look like me. And I thought maybe I'll try doing a woman. And there was a sort of, at the time I went to drama school, couldn't get arrested, and I thought, well, I can do, but I was doing impersonations, doing stand-up, and I thought, well, there's a way of doing that and a way of doing stand-up comedy and doing combining that with acting, because I was doing impersonations and I wasn't really satisfied with it, and this is 30 something years ago, and I thought, well, actually I combine acting with stand-up, I'll do these characters, I'll try and do a character. And there was, you know, I used to do this drunk guy in college that made people laugh, sort of. And there was guys across the road at the pub that hated us because we were drama students and they were like tax-paying working-class men and hated the fact that they subsidised our prancing around in tights, you know, at drama school. And I thought that was quite an interesting, you know, point of view. I just started to articulate it. Paul Coffers, I also like, there is a certain kind of... a brevity of expression amongst the working class of the North at its best is witty and concise and economical and beautifully expressed. And, a few choice words can illuminate something far more than an intellectual sort of verbosity.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of what I was trying to tap into with that. I do sometimes miss that, you know. I mean, but you sort of can't do everything. I mean, Paul and Pauline were great. I also made sure that Pauline was, Paul Calf was someone who's down on his luck. Pauline Calf was someone who is empowered and always was. I wanted to make her strong and not be, partly because I didn't want to do a thing of just diminishing a woman, if you like, female character. So I always made her be elevated and in control and make her brother Paul Calf be the victim, as it were.
Yeah. I came from a family with two older sisters and I'm pretty much convinced that my empathy towards women and my need to support women's organisations and strong women generally and love of strong women, it all comes from my family background. And I think it makes a big difference having sisters who you can relate to. Because men who grow up on their own, just, you know, or just in an all-boy family is a different matter entirely. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I mean, I was, it wasn't a macho family, but it was sort of masculine, definitely masculine. But it was about, you know, doing the right thing, helping people, think for yourself, don't follow the crowd. I mean, I had an older brother, Martin, who had his moment in the sun. He was in the Mock Turtles.
That's right, yeah.
And he put me, your music, you know, when I was growing up was really formative for me and sort of played into that idea of thinking outside the box and seeing something that had a different perspective, that had an otherness about it. And that was what I gravitated towards. I didn't want to listen to what everyone else was listening. I mean, the mist of time, you look back on music that you had antipathy towards and actually appreciate it in its context. But at the time, music was quite tribal. Pursuing something that was just out of reach, or being sort of aspirant. I think something to do with. I mean, I went to a grammar school, and I think a lot of working class men, certainly up north, discovered art and literature.
Same as me. Yeah.
Post-war, yeah. And it's sort of, you sort of thought, there's another world out there that sort of goes beyond the imagination of your parents. Being working class, and my parents certainly was about providing and being responsible grown-up members of society and trying to be model people in a sort of a, you know, help people, provide a nice home, all those things, and had points of view about things. But the idea of trying to reach beyond your imagination is something new, and something I got from school. You know, and you discover things like William Blake and Wilfred Owen and all those things dissenting voices.
Exactly.
Your music definitely played.
Thank you. It's very kind of you. I remember in your book, you're talking about your brother and kind of idolizing him a little bit and, you know, kind of following his taste in music. And then you kind of started diverging. And he suddenly one day decided to. He liked electronic music a lot, and then that had an influence on you. So I suppose that was part of it as well.
It was. I like the sort of, how can you know, austere nihilism.
Yes.
Of a lot of it, because it, to me, it was like almost anti that pop songs about falling in love all seemed very vapid to me when I was a teenager. And, Human League and... yourselves and BEF, all that there was something that was good. What I liked about it was it wasn't entirely graspable, wasn't it? It was sort of, there was an air of mystery about it.
And it wasn't graspable for us either. We didn't know what we were doing.
But the thing is, I think there's something about that which is super creativity, is that when you're properly creative, you don't entirely know what you're doing. You're just following an instinct.
Yeah.
Those first two albums and even things like Dignity of Labour. There's I think it's Dignity of Labour 3, track 3.
It's really good that I think. I mean, I think so now. It's almost like somebody else did it, to be honest.
Really? Yeah. I think it's alarming to me. And also that the even Dance Vision, which I know you recorded on a 2-track tape player. I think in
that's right. Yeah.
Anyway, that to me is still incredibly evocative, and like I say, at the time, that's the kind of thing when you're an impressionable teenager, as I was, is you hold on to and you sort of anchor yourself to and go, I don't know what that is, but there's something about it which is beyond my experience or challenging. And I think that is part of what I've taken forward. When I write now, you know, because I've written dramas and things things changed for me when I wrote this film, Philomena.
Philomena was fantastic, by the way. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. That changed things for me. And I've just, you know, now I do sort of, I've written other dramatic things. We've just done a film about the discovering the body of Richard III in a car park in which is a
sort what's it of called?
Drama. It's called The Lost King, and Sally Hawkins stars in it. And
I suggest it might have been better to call it Leicester Car Park. It'd be better.
I'm not sure how accessible that is or how enticing that is. But it's a drama. It's a real story. I'm into telling stories and using humour as an ingredient. What I've done is that humour is great in and of itself, as an end in itself, but it's actually, to me, more interesting as a tool in your box to make things that are, it might seem initially intangible, is to make them accessible. You sugar the pill with some comedy.
Nice.
You can bring people in to something that might be too esoteric. ordinarily. And that is, to me, is really liberating. So you do a drama and you sprinkle some comedy where it occurs naturally, and you can bring people towards things that might seem
inaccessible,
yeah, beyond them. So
I mean, we had a similar thing, I suppose, with We Don't Need That Fascist Groove Thing, although it's a bold title.
Yeah.
I mean, trying to get the message across through, in this case, manic 160 BPM electronic dance music, you know.
Yeah, because it was fast, that's right. It was fast. I remember it was faster than disco. It is fast. It's like, it's a bit quicker than disco beat, isn't it?
Yeah. Slightly.
Yeah.
Like Gabba.
I remember that at the time. That's a very bold title. That's a very postmodern title. It's like almost a deliberately unwieldy title, which is
exactly.
I totally understand. The thing is, I used to get what you were doing. It's like I started to get what they're doing. I know what they're doing. I've sort of followed everything you're doing. I think it's matured a lot of that music, strangely. Like sort of
fine wine, hardly, but I get it. Yeah. But thank you, it's really kind of you to say all this. And the check's in the post. I am in awe of your work ethic. I mean, I'm similar, but I was just looking at the amount of TV and film that you've done, and you know, it's not Nicolas Cage where it's just any old shit will do. This is all. Well, I would say 90% of it is really quality work. And good Lord, it's an incredible body of work that you've created. I mean, I often think that you could have a big exhibition in the V&A about the world of work that you've created, or not the V&A, maybe, British Museum, I don't know, Tate. Yeah. Should we say Tate? Let's say Tate.
Yeah.
if you need music for that, I'm all over it.
Yours was a soundtrack to my youth.
Do you think of the world of all your creations as being like this holistic whole?
The only common denominator is, I'm fortunate enough to do different things, jump around. I'm writing a live tour now. I've just finished six, just finished 3.5 months playing Jimmy Savile for BBC.
My God, tell us about that.
I can't go into too much detail about it because it's very sensitive. There's a lot of controversy in it. But it's a drama written by Neil Mackay, who has great provenance. It speaks for itself. It's a drama about what he did, how he got away with it, who facilitated it, his voice to the victims, etc., etc. I thought long and hard before I did it, and it's complete now. But the reason I got a bald head is because I have to wear all these different wigs when sort of depicting him at various points in his life, and that is, of course, a very serious, heavy drama. And I'm lucky to be able to have those opportunities to tell a story like that. It's a really important story. I think that I think when it comes out, it will vindicate itself. There are doubters and naysayers, some people who are detractors, as there always will be. I think when you get comfortable in the career, if you've stuck your head above the parapet and made comments, you know that you will have detractors. I think you should do it. It's healthy, you know. If everyone likes what you do, you're probably doing something wrong. Unless you're Judi Dench, she gets a free pass. But I think if everyone likes what you do, there's something. I think it's healthy to have to know that some people can't bear you. I'm very comfortable with that.
I'm really
comfortable with it. I did that before that. I just finished a series called Chivalry, which is dealing with romance in the Me Too environment,
right? Wow.
Which is for Channel 4. Be out soon. I wrote with Sarah Soleimani. That is a conversation between an unreconstructed white middle-aged man and a feminist And it's about how, can romance thrive in the post, in the sort of era of woke gender politics. And that to me is like, okay, well, no one's doing that stuff because it terrifies them. But to me, I gravitate towards that. I think, well, and Sarah and I just said, let's write a conversation between a man and a woman.
Yeah.
And that is funny, and is not virtue signaling, and neither is it just reactionary. Or like all these things, it's a conversation, and the pendulum swings both ways. So that you know, and before that, I did the Richard III thing, which I wrote with Jeff Pope. And yeah. I'm fortunate I can jump around and do all these things. So
my favourite thing that you've done in the last few years has been Saxondale, to be honest. I think it was sublimely understated.
Yeah, but you know what? That's I'm pleased you said that, because that's, to me, is of all the things I've done, it's like what I love about that character, and I miss it actually. I'd love to somehow reboot it. Is
Can he do a prequel to it? Like his real the life he led as an actual roadie? And
I don't think sometimes depicting something is not as compelling as relating it.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Relating it after the fact. If someone tells you a story, that's why sometimes people adapt books and they don't work on screen, because if you describe on the page how someone looks, it's always more enjoyable than just seeing a photograph or a picture of them, because it's one comment. It's an instant thing, and you see something, you go, well, I can see that. But if someone can't show you a picture and has to describe it with the written word, it's more artful, and therefore it's just saying, let's see the stuff he talks about. Well, actually, his rendition of it, his embellishment, the idea of the unreliable narrator is enjoyable in and of itself. And it's, I think it's a mistake sometimes to go, let's just see the stuff he talks about.
It
might work, but there's a big risk. It's risky. That I like the fact that that Saxon there was a world-weary man whose sort of glory days probably behind him. And because he's got an assistant, that's his audience to impart his world wisdom to, and which is how we structured it. And also that he wasn't quite, he was sort of almost apolitical. He was just anti-establishment. And sometimes that was a little bit right-wing, and sometimes it was a little bit left-wing. But he was just wanted to be a rebel. Didn't quite know what that meant, you know. And
and a bit stuck in where he's at. But what I found was really fascinating is that occasionally he'd win. So he wasn't just a kind of, you know, everything's in the past and his successes were in the past. You're not really even sure how successful the successes were. But occasionally, surprisingly, he would come out. It'd be like Wile E. Coyote catching Roadrunner, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, to me, what we what distinguishes him from Partridge was that Alan Partridge is a fool, if you like. He's Malvolio. He always gets things wrong. We laugh at his follies and his views. Saxondale, on the other hand, would sometimes be delusional, but sometimes he'd be genuinely witty and clever and smart. So you go, that was a really interesting time. Made him more complex. So occasionally you'd think he's really on the money about that. Really, really incisive, funny, witty, clever. And then sometimes he'd just be self-delusional. And both those things together made him more nuanced.
Very, very good. Very, very clever characterizing. And it deserves further outing, I think you're right.
There was something in the paper recently, it was in the Telegraph sort of talk, doing retrospective, saying the lost genius of Saxondale or something like that. It was one of those things where someone reappraised it, and I thought, oh, I'm pretty pleased about that, because he got sort of lost in the melee of Partridge, the wake of Partridge. But I'm still very fond of it, and the idea of he's got a good heart. He's ostensibly a nice man.
Yeah.
That's what I liked about him.
Related,
I think he says, and he's very unreconstructed, analog music man. And I think he says, one of the comments early on says, no, when he's talking about the kind of music he's prepared to listen to at work, says to the young assistant, "No electronic bollocks. If I want to listen to electronic bleeps and farts, I'll stick my foot through the windscreen of the rascal and listen to the alarm going off."
That is funny. That is definitely funny. Of all the films that you've done, which is the one that you're most pleased with, do you think? All right, can I just put a word in for Tropic Thunder? Your cameo in that made me roll with laughter. I just thought it was so well observed.
Oh, thanks. I exit 15 minutes into the movie, but by stepping on a landmine.
It's brilliant.
I've got a picture of my seven-year-old daughter at the time holding my severed head.
The head, yeah.
Which is disturbing, to say the least. But I mean, 24. It's 20 years this year since we did 24-hour Party People.
No, wow.
I organised a screening of it. It was something. The first film I did with Michael Winterbottom. I've done 8 films with him subsequently, but that was. That holds a great place in my heart because it was, you know, I grew up in Manchester, so I was sort of retelling a story that I had been, if you like, a spectator of on the sidelines, reliving my youth, but pretending to be at the center of it, which I wasn't. But I was there on the periphery, you know. And I, funnily enough, the Hacienda nightclub that was famed in Manchester, I did a gig there in supporting a band. When I started out doing comedy, there were no alternative comedy venues, so all you could do is support indie bands. And I supported my brother's band at the Hacienda in December 86, Anyway, the fact is, fast forward to us making the movie 24-Hour Party People, and the Hacienda has been demolished, and they rebuilt a replica of it in a warehouse in Ancoats, before Ancoats became gentrified as the Northern Quarter. It was a very unreal experience, because I walked into this space that was exactly like this club that I remember being at in my youth. So just the whole exploration of that era and being Tony Wilton playing Tony, who was sort of a bit of a joke when we were growing up. He was sort of like, funny enough, growing up in Manchester, everyone knew about Tony Wilson as this sort of music kind of guru, and he also presented the news. And he was always seen as a bit of we used to think he was an old bloke trying to be hip and trendy. But he was probably only about 32 at the time.
Seemed impossibly old at the time. But he gave us our first break on TV. I mean, we were on So It Goes.
Really?
Yeah, that was the first TV appearance of the early.
Really? Yeah.
I think he fancied Phil, to be honest.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I remember Rock and Roll on Top of the Pops.
Oh, yeah.
And thinking, oh, my God, you know. I mean, those are things like the mystery of the band at that time is that the imagery was scant. So you as a band could curate completely the way you are presented.
That's right.
It's no longer possible to see too many different... when you listen to music, then you just stared at the album cover and reread the notes and just stared at this small group of images. And so actually seeing someone on TV, it was something like, oh, I can see them moving about. moving. And I can see what they look like from different angles. It's really fascinating at the time.
I had that experience with the first Rocks Music album and the gatefold sleeve, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And you stand it up and put the record on, obviously, no CDs. And just, you know, deeply absorb. Imagine going to an art gallery and you stood in front of the same painting for, you know, half an hour. It's ridiculous. Yeah. So it really had a massive impact on me, that kind of, album covers. And of course, when CDs started, we largely lost that, you know.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it is true. There was definitely an immersive experience. This sort of, you know, attention deficit disorder we have these days, everything's going to be instant and quick. And in some ways, it has produced some great art, but it's limited a lot of other things. I mean, I just seriously with Rob Brydon, the trip,
yep,
which we did four incarnations of. I think part of the reason it had an appeal to people was that it was sort of very languid and slow paced, and people could sort of sit into it and go, oh, if you alter your mindset, it's quite enjoyable. If you used to, you know, I think a lot of it probably appeals to older audiences than millennials, because it's just, it's that engaging in a very slow, casual conversation. Yeah,
it's like slow TV, isn't it? That kind of theory. Yeah. Oh, also, I've got another theory about these.
I used to call it Last of the Summer Wine for Guardian readers.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. We wanted to do a series called Last of the Summer Synths in Homeford, because that's, you know, that they love synth music up there for some reason.
Yeah.
Out. And that's where that was filmed, wasn't it? Last of the Summer Wine.
Yeah.
We're coming close to the end of this. You'll be glad to hear. Have you got any further with your Irish citizenship application?
It's a very good question. So make a call about that. The reason that it was taking so long is that there's obviously a backlog, a backlog, and people just sort of scrambling for the lifeboats. You know?
Yeah, I managed to get into the lifeboat with my family. We did it. We got an early step on it 18 months ago. So we're now officially Irish citizens, which is awesome.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. So it'll come through soon enough. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I always finish these things with kind of smash its type question. Oh, one thing. Were you ever in a band? Did you ever want to be in a band?
I was in very briefly. I was in a band with some mates. I was a lead singer for about 3 months in a band called Dark Phase.
Ooh. Bravo! Tip of the hat, sir.
Terrible title. A mate of mine was in a band called Barabbas, which he said was great because you say, "Who do we want? Barabbas!" My brother was always in the band. I just followed my brother's music, and I can play the piano a little bit, which I've learned with the others, and I'm quite sort of pleased with. I see, even now I make little compositions. My secret pleasure is that during lockdown, I've been doing a lot of writing. Then I go and sit at the piano and basically do scores and try and compose things in like a John Barry-esque way, you know, like choosing discords getting more and more experimental with sort of chord structures and then melodies and intertwine. And that's what I do. I just do it for myself.
Right.
And it's really meditative.
Do you record on Logic or anything like that? Is that what you?
No, I just play them, but they're all in my head on the piano. I could, like, you know, they're all. But I love unorthodox chord structures that are disturbing, and then have a sort of narrative structure. It's quite good for some writings. I mean, no one really hears it apart from mates. I go, hey, listen to this. You know, like,
I'd love to hear it. If you ever need any help with making them into something bigger, then let me know. I'll have to reveal it to the public. It's okay.
I'll send you some little ditties and you can.
Yeah, please do. Okay. So smash its type questions. These are quite quick. So, what's your favorite film?
Kind Hearts and Coronets.
Oh, that's such a great film.
About Dennis Price and Alec Guinness about a man who kills all the people between himself and the Duke, inherit the dukedom, and it's done with a lot of black, understated black humour, and is very, very clever, witty, well written, and just glorious in Dennis Price for Alec Guinness is superb playing all these characters. It just has a really understated dark English wit, if you like. I've watched that several times. I mean, that's particular sensibility. There's a few good ones. I mean, Harold and Maud by Hal Ashby, which has Cat Stevens music in it, is a glorious life affirming movie as well. Yeah,
we like that. Yeah. Favorite book?
One
of them.
Confederacy of Dunces.
Somebody else said that recently, actually. I've never read it. I must get around to reading that.
Yeah, I do like that. Anything really that's... I like things that are unorthodox and challenging and witty. Something that... So I put that as my favourite.
Good. TV show. It could be anything, you know, old, new, box set, whatever.
TV show is, I think... it would probably, I think it would have to be, it would have to be Fawlty Towers, I think, really, because in the 1970s growing up, that was before VHSs, and, you know, there was that watching television was a communal experience, and you knew that the rest of the country were watching at the same time. That's disappeared largely. The idea the next morning,
at school.
We all talk about it and deconstruct it. And before, the ability to record or access it instantly, it meant that you had to retain it within your memory. You had to recollect it. So we would watch that show as a family, turn the TV off, and then afterwards do a post-mortem and talk about what our favourite bits have been and relive them and say, it was funny when he said that and when he said this. And that was such a... So to me, not just because of the poem, but because of that formative experience of something shared when people sit around and share this experience, that was a perfect marriage of the edge and experimentation of Monty Python mixed with the broadness of a BBC sitcom, and that was a perfect storm for me. That's the perfect marriage of be ambitious, try and reach beyond the comfort zone of what everyone else is doing, but don't go sailing off into the clouds. Keep it anchored to the ground so that as many people as possible can enjoy what you're doing. And that was a perfect storm, that show.
Art by the people for the people is how I look at it. Yeah. Visual or conceptual artist?
That's interesting. I don't dismiss conceptual art, because I think it's really interesting. But I think, you know, I mean, for all the provocation of Tracy Emin's Tent, you know, I like visual art. You know, I think that's not to say that there's not a place for conceptual art, because it's important, but. And there's some stuff that's really provocative, and there's sort of that who's that guy that does that immersive stuff that Jonathan Tate, that guy that does, like, did The Foggy Room, I can't remember what his name is.
Eliasson.
Yes,
Olafur Eliasson.
He's from Iceland. Yeah.
That's he's from,
is it? Yeah.
Is it Iceland? Or no.
Norway.
It might be. No, it's not Iceland. It's Finland. Oh, I don't know. Yeah. I've been to his museum, actually, and it's...
Well, anyway, yeah, so that stuff is really, you know, is good. It's provocative. I quite like that Ron Muick, that guy who does that.
Yeah, giant... he's good. The giant babies.
I like stuff like that because it's accessible. I don't like the mystification of art, which is an elitist thing. It's enfranchised people from it. And that Ron Muick stuff got people turn the nose up a bit, because you go, well, it's too accessible, so it can't be art. Well, that's bollocks.
Yeah, it is bollocks. What about, if you'd not been a comedian or a writer, what do you think your alternative, if the path had gone in a different direction, what do you think you might have ended up doing as a career? Or can you not conceptualize that?
Maybe something to do with art. I like cars. It's like designing cars. I used to be very good at drawing the 3D, you know.
Designer.
I sort of liked that.
Product designer.
I like, you know, I'm an aesthete, you know, sort of slightly snobby one. And I like,
polymath aesthete.
Yeah, I do like creating environments that make me happy and the, you know, all that stuff. Something.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Who's your favorite actor or director or?
I am a big fan of. Well, I like the directors. I think are uncelebrated are non-auteur directors, if you like. Mm-hmm. Therefore, like Stephen Frears, who fortunately I've had the chance to.
He did one of our videos.
Did he really?
Yeah, he did a Come Live With Me video. Yeah.
Did he really? Bloody
yeah! Hell. Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
God! Wow. Stephen, Stephen. So he's a good friend of mine now, and he just did the Richard III movie we just made. So Steve, I would put Stephen up there as one of those people, like along with directors like Sidney Lumet, Sidney Pollack, George Roy Hill, Alan J. Pakula. Those directors were directors who are, and I include Frears with that group, are people who served the material and just told good stories. Sidney Pollack did Tootsie, he did it Out of Africa, he did 3 Days of Condor. He just said, how can I, this is a comedy.
How do I
make the comedy work? How do I make this thriller work? So he just applied himself to the job and tried to do it the best he could and almost not get in the way of it and make it work as a movie. So the biggest thing you can say about it is that it really works as a movie, and the director's almost invisible in a way in the end. And it doesn't put a stamp on it. George Roy Hill did Butch Cassidy, which is an incredible film, and to this day is an amazing film. It's basically a film about the counterculture disguised as a Western. And then The Sting. And he, a director like him, he flew bombers in the Second World War. And their attitude to directing was very, it was like unpretentious. It was like building a table or building a desk or something. It was like a carpenter's approach to filmmaking. It's like
craft-based,
the job, and you have to execute it properly.
Exactly.
Something to be admired about that.
Exactly. Okay, who makes you laugh?
Who makes me laugh? Frankie Boyle makes me laugh. Les Dawson, maybe.
Oh, piano playing.
Yeah.
I seek the internet for his piano playing episodes in his. Yeah. Oh my God.
He had some great lines. Some great lines that even stay with me to this day. Which things like. I met my wife on the Tunnel of Love. She was digging it. it was great. He just created.
You could tell when the mother-in-law's coming over because the mice start throwing themselves on the traps.
The other one I thought was like, she used to work on a whaling ship. She'd dive in and strangle them. I love the fact that he just creates an instant image in your head.
I bought a novel that he wrote about being a comedian in the working men's club environment.
Yes, I know. I think I know this because my company flirted with it. I can't remember what's it called.
Can't remember, but it was really
Jack of Clubs.
Yes, that was it. Yeah. Knave of Clubs, or I don't know, whatever.
Jack
of Clubs, something like that. Unfulfilled ambition.
To direct something, to tell a story, I'm hoping to tick it off at some point, but it's something I haven't done yet, and there's a slight fear about it. It's like imposter syndrome, vibe about it. But then I sort of look around and I go, well, hang on, he's doing it. Well, if he can do it, I can do it.
You can do it.
There's a couple of things I want to do. That's really.
Epiphanal moment in your life.
I think it would have been about 30 years ago, I suppose. when first started out, I was just grateful to have the work, and I sort of kept my mouth shut about stuff. And then I just thought, I think it was 2 people. One is working with Armando Iannucci in 30 years ago doing radio, when I was in there reading material, making me cry laughing, thinking, this, I can't imagine anyone else, any other group of people I'd rather work with right now in the world than the people I'm in this room with now. That was, and it was challenging. And I thought, this is going to be a tipping point. And knowing that they were all smart and they weren't afraid of being avant-garde, and they were like, this is the sweet spot. This is where I need to be.
Yeah.
This is it. That was one. The other one was when I took legal action against Rupert Murdoch, against the advice of a lot of friends of mine. I said, don't do that. You'll make enemies of him. They'll come after you, blah, 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 blah. And I had been turned over by the press quite a lot, and I'd seen their abuses and so many political, emotional reasons why I loathe the tabloid as being the worst expression of Britishness. Everything that is wrong with our country is tied up in that. The Philistine, egregious, ugly humanity
yes.
of Rupert Murdoch and everything he represents. And the people who, his sycophants, including Andy Coulson, who went to prison, ultimately as a result of the action that myself and other people took. That was an angry act that I thought, I don't care about this idea of just keeping your head down. I thought, fuck it. And that to me was liberating. It was like...
Brilliant.
Some people are going to hate you for it. The Daily Mail take every opportunity to have a go at me. I don't give a flying fuck. I'm really happy with what I do.
Well said.
I'm happy that the Daily Mail don't like me. I wear it as a badge of pride.
That's an endorsement.
I think they're a bunch of cunts.
Yes!
That's not to say that I don't embrace humanity and celebrate all that is good about humanity.
Exactly.
Through the work I do. And I just, but that not being afraid of
power,
disagreeing with it, being afraid of power, that, yeah. and also feeling secure enough and thinking, I don't think I can be, I felt like I had a certain kind of immunity to their witches or their ability to, because I'd never really courted them in the first place. So, but anyway, that to me was an epiphany. Yeah.
Well, I've got an enormous respect for your bravery in that respect. Well, all respect. You're creatively brave, but also, you know, that was a proper decision to make. And I think having read your autobiography, and I know the depths to which these people will go. I've had a slight taste of it myself, but nothing like that. I've got nothing but admiration for you for that. Okay, final question. What's your favourite... Oh, you probably don't know this, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I ask everyone. What's your favourite synthesiser? I bet you've never played with one, have you?
I've years ago. I remember... funny enough, I've not touched one for years, but I remember in the early 80s, the DX7 was ubiquitous. The Yamaha,
yeah.
Actually a bit insipid now.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of it.
No, it was everywhere. But I've got affection for it because I was like, oh, you can make yourself sound like you can write music. but no, I think, I like, only for sentimental reasons. Well, I remember at the time, the Synclavier and the Phalanx.
Oh, yeah.
TMI, both those were mythical beasts to me. I'd heard about them. I'd seen pictures of them. I remember I went to a studio not that long ago and I saw Synclavier and went, wow, is that Synclavier? I went, yeah, gathering dust in the corner, obsolete, irrelevant. And I remember thinking, that was like a rare animal. when I was a teenager, it was like, you think, wow, that's an unattainable thing. I mean, I sort of got goosebumps thinking about the Synclavier. But I suppose for sentimental reasons, my brother had the cat. Which was a duophonic synthesizer that was non-programmable. So you had big sheets of paper where you'd write down where every dial and slider was. And you'd have a stack of sheets of paper, and it would say brass on the top, string.
Yeah.
And the attack and pay down. And you'd have to spend like 5 minutes putting every single thing in the right place and go, right, that's going to be about the sort of brass sounding ish. Yeah. And that there's something actually wonderfully pioneering about the lack of sophistication of those, yeah, those very early sort of analog synths. And actually,
non-programmable,
the,
yeah.
Yeah, and the brutal sound of them, which you captured, you know, in the early days.
Can you imagine when we first started performing that we had to change patches on this machine, actually, that machine. That's what we did being boiled on. And what we performed live with. We had to change patches in between songs. So that's why we got the slides up with the early Human League, because we realised how boring it must be for the audience. Because, Phil wasn't exactly Les Dawson. There was no kind of patter going on at all. He was just stood there in abject terror, grasping hold of the mic stand. So that's why it turned into a kind of art thing, you know, and thank God, you know.
Well, then necessity is the mother of invention, as they say.
Yeah, exactly. On that bombshell... Well, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough. I'm going to ask Anna, your lovely assistant, if she'll give me an address to send something as a thank you, because I've got something special in mind for you.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for providing the soundtrack to helping me think outside the box.
Well, you definitely do think outside the box, of that there is no doubt. This has been one of my favourite ever episodes. Thank you so much. Good luck with the tour. I shall be tapping you up for a
freebie. Don't worry, you'll get.
In return, you can come and see either Heaven 17 or the Reproduction Traveller tour shows if we ever restage them.
Yeah, I know. I'm well up for that. I was in the States last time. Otherwise, I would have been there like a shot. So yes, I'm well up for that.
All right, man. Okay. Thanks so much. Lots of love.
Take care, Martin.
Bye. What can you say about Steve? He's everything I hoped he would be in terms of the depth of his understanding of his own art and his own work. And I was just looking on Wikipedia at the list of films and TV that he's done. He's an absolute workaholic. He's driven to create good work all the time and to think outside the box and to get outside his comfort zone. All the things that I'm always saying to my students, for instance, that they need to do. As soon as he gets comfortable with something, I get the impression that he wants to subvert it in some way or break it and reform it. I mean, the stuff he's done that I've loved, I think I've seen everything he's done, more or less. I mean, all the Alan Partridge stuff, Saxon Dale, Tropic Thunder, that cameo in Tropic Thunder, 24 Hour Party People, Alpha Papa, Stan and Ollie. What a fantastic portrayal of Stan Laurel, you know, The Look of Love, underestimated film. We didn't get to talk about a lot of the stuff. Philomena. You know, that is a brave film to make. That could have gone very badly wrong. And, you know, Knowing Me, Knowing You, and This Time, and Welcome to the Places of My Life, and Saxon Dale again. You know, he's doing Jimmy Savile. My God, how brave is that to take that on? You know, for some people, they might go, God, I can't take, that's just too close to the bone. I can't take that on. The Trip, you know. His dealings with the press and the Coulson Inquiry and all that stuff, phone hacking, taking it all on, brave soul. He's a brave soul. There's no doubt about it. And I've just got total admiration for him. And I think he's fucking hilarious as well. So, hope you enjoyed that. It's certainly probably my favourite ever podcast I've done. Hope everybody's well and surviving these weird times. Hope these podcasts help in some way to entertain you and take your mind off things. A slight error that I made in the recording was that I said that Stephen Frears directed Come Live With Me. In fact, he directed This Is Mine. Time for some more emails.
Hello, Martin. Just joining in with the rest of your listeners to tell you, great show. Absolutely loving your choice of guests, and the stories are brilliant. So much better come from the horse's mouth. I am a horse. A candidate for the future, the very wonderful ex-partner of someone you know very well, Mr. Alan Rankin. Well, I've already done it. A lot of these emails are quite old now, but I'm just getting around to reading them. So apologies if it's out of chronological sequence. And it was good. That's it. Thank you, Del. This is from Timo. Hi, Martin. I love discovering music I've never heard. Thank you for introducing me to Van de Graaff Generator. They're brilliant. I definitely hear Lydon and Bowie and early rock singing. Am I going down a progressive rabbit hole? It appears so. Hope you're well. But you know what? I really don't like labels on music. To me, music is... it's useful for kind of organising your thoughts and for journalists, I suppose. But to me, good music's good music. I don't really care where it comes from or what genre it's in. If it comes from the heart, I love it. So glad to hear you will have an episode on new artists. The children are our future. Treat them well and let them lead the way. I feel I have only begun to express old fart speaking. Much love to you and your loved ones. Thank you, Timo. This is from John Jeff Ungar. Hello, Martin. Top marks for hosting such a sterling podcast. Each one's an absolute gem. What a rare privilege. Thank you. It's a bit long, this, so I'm skipping over bits. All pioneers of electronic music, music production. Loves those early heady experimental DIY decades of the 70s and 80s that revolutionised popular music following the introduction of the synthesizer. Your chats with Midgeu and Chris Watson are among my personal favourites. Then it goes on to talk about modern English. A guy called Mick Conroy used to be the bassist. Thank you, Jeff. I'll bear that in mind.
Big shout out to SJM Concerts for continuing to support the podcast, sponsor of the podcast. They're a great company. They represent a load of great artists in this country and putting on concerts. We all need entertainment nowadays. And Simon Moran, who's the originator, is head of SJM Concerts. Thank you so much for sponsoring this podcast. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you. Feel free to email me on electronicallymartin, that's Martin with a Y, at gmail.com, with any comments about the shows, positive, negative, hopefully not negative, ideas for segments, ideas for guests. I'm going to continue doing this while I am enjoying doing it, basically. So there you go. I will have another stellar guest for you next week. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I'm thrilled. Bye!